Palestine amid the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza.
Our armed forces, with the help of Allah Almighty, continue for the third consecutive week to responsibly and effectively confront the ongoing American aggression against our country. They engage with enemy warships led by the American aircraft carrier Truman in the Red Sea three times over the past 24 hours.
The Army spokesman Brigadier General Sarin noted that the operations involved multiple cruise missiles and drones, showcasing Yemen's growing defensive capabilities. He stressed that the attacks on U.S. and Israeli targets will not come to an end until the aggression on Gaza stops and the siege there is lifted. Now, the operations came as the U.S. military earlier pounded areas across Yemen, bombing the northwestern province of Sada'a for nearly 20 times in a matter of hours. Yusuf Mowry joined us earlier from Sana'a with details regarding Yemen's latest anti-U.S. operations.
The Yemeni armed forces, the naval forces, they seem to have escalated their military strategy when it comes to attacking the USS Harry Truman in the Red Sea. Previously, they were only attacking the main aircraft carrier itself because that is the launching pad for these U.S. fighter jets. They are launching from the USS aircraft carrier. The jets are launching from it and carrying out the attacks across Yemen. However, there's this change in strategy because now the Yemeni armed forces are also targeting the warships. The warships, the smaller pieces that are accompanying the USS Harry Truman aircraft carrier, because these are the warships that carry the bulk of the air defense, which is used to intercept or shoot down the missiles and the drones that are directed from Yemen towards the aircraft carrier. And this seems to be the strategy going forward, is not just going to be to attack the main hub of the U.S. Aircraft carrier, but also any type of military manifestation by the U.S. in the Red Sea. There's also prominent Ansarullah officials who are now beginning to threaten that all U.S. military bases across the entirety of the region, including military bases in Africa, they're also going to be on the target list.
So speaking of Yemen and the operations there, we have the breaking news for you. Armed Forces of Yemen saying that Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv has been targeted using Yemeni ballistic missiles. Now, sirens have sounded in several areas of the occupied Palestinian territories following a fresh missile strike from Yemen. The Israeli military confirmed the ballistic missile attack, adding that it was intercepted. No media reports whether the strikes left any casualties. Yemen has repeatedly vowed to strike Israeli targets inside the occupied lands and vessels bound for Israel in the Red Sea in response to the regime's genocidal campaign against Palestinians. The country resumed its anti-Israel operations after a two-month hiatus. Sana'a has cited Israel's failure to abide by the terms of a ceasefire in Gaza and refusal to allow humanitarian aid into the Strip. Israel's latest strikes have claimed the lives of more than two dozen civilians and left many others injured across the besieged Gaza Strip. One of the latest attacks killed three Palestinians and injured several others after Israeli boats targeted the vicinity of Al-Nur Mosque, west of Deir al-Bala, in central Gaza. Six people, including three women, were killed and many others injured in northern Gaza Strip as well. In the southern city of Rafah, an Israeli drone strike killed a 9-year-old child and injured five, mostly children. Another drone strike hit a house in Rafah, killing an 8-year-old child and injuring his mother and sister. Six civilians were killed when an Israeli strike targeted a house east of Khan Yunis in the south. An Israeli air raid on a Palestinian home in Beit Lahia, northern Gaza, caused fatalities. The death toll from the genocide is now near 50,000, and 300, there are also more than 114,000 people injured. Now, the Israeli military has also launched a new phase of ground operations south of the siege Gaza Strip. The IOF says the ground operations, which commenced in the Janaina neighborhood of Rafah, aims to expand what is described as a security zone in southern Gaza. U.S. media reported earlier that Israel was preparing for a, quote, major assault on Gaza. Israel has resumed the bombing campaign and ground operations in Gaza since March 18th, and that after unilaterally ending a ceasefire agreement with Hamas. The regime also imposed a total ban on the entry of much-needed international aid into the besieged territory. A senior Hamas official says the movement has agreed to a new Gaza ceasefire proposal offered by mediators and is awaiting the Israeli regime's response. Khalil al-Hayya said that Hamas has responded positively and responsibly to the new proposal. He expressed hope that the occupation regime would not obstruct the proposal and thwart the mediators' efforts. Hayya, however, stressed the resistance weapon as a red line as it is linked to the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. He noted that the resistance would not accept any deal that would involve expulsion and displacement of Palestinians. He said the cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu continues to stall and prevent realization of a ceasefire agreement. Hayya added Netanyahu is trying to prolong the war on Gaza to ensure the survival of his cabinet for as long as possible. He said Netanyahu understands that the survival of his cabinet depends on the continuation of the Gaza war. Author and political analyst Eve Engler believes that Israel cannot be trusted with any deal and that the international community must pressure the regime to uphold its side of the Gaza truce.
There's no reason to trust Israel. The people, you know, Katz was pretty straightforward a few days ago now, I guess a week ago maybe, about their genocidal intent. They want to kill and they want to kill. They want to drive everyone out. And the ceasefire is obviously an impediment in doing that. And so you know, shouldn't be trusted. Now, you know, what's the alternative, though, unfortunately, from Hamas's perspective? They've been agreeing to the previous proposal that was supposed to go to round two, and Israel's, you know, avoiding. But it's a matter of international pressure, and that's not easy to organize when you have this administration in Washington that is totally fanatical in their hostility to you know, Palestinians. So you don't trust Israel. You have to keep putting pressure. And obviously, part of, you know, from Hamas's perspective, part of the pressure is being able to respond militarily. And then for those of us who are not in Gaza, who are, you know, international, you know, here in Canada, is to put pressure on my government, which just you know, it just came out that they approved $80 million arms. They claim to have stopped arms transfers, but they just approved an $80 million contract.
Now, thousands of demonstrators have taken to the streets of Melbourne demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and an end to Australia's support for the Israeli regime. Now, the protesters marched through the city to show solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza and condemn Israel's attacks on the Palestinian land. Elsewhere, Melbourne University students held their own rally calling for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. They denounced the university's complicity in the ongoing genocide and urged their institutions to cut ties with the companies linked to the Tel Aviv regime. Scuffles breaking out in Tel Aviv between Israeli forces and demonstrators who asked the regime to stop attacking Gaza and secure the release of all captives held there. The protesters denounced the handling of the Gaza war by the cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu and repeated violations of the ceasefire deal. They warned that returning to the war in Gaza could sacrifice their loved ones, stressing that military pressure cannot save the captives. The protesters also slammed the regime's efforts to dismiss the head of Shin Bet and the attorney general, who are opposed to Netanyahu. The new rally followed a surge in demonstrations throughout the week across the occupied Palestinian lands. The weekly protests reveal a rising dissent against Netanyahu's cabinet over the resumption of the onslaught on Gaza. The Secretary General of the Hezbollah movement has condemned Israel's repeated violations of the ceasefire deal with Lebanon. Sheikh Naim Qassem warned that the resistance group's patience has limits.
Everything has a limit. Don't take what we say lightly. Be aware that this resistance is present and it is committed at this time to the agreement. However, if Israel doesn't commit at all and if the Lebanese state isn't able to bring about the necessary results or the required results politically, we would hence have no such choice to resort to other options.
Qassem urged the Lebanese government to enforce the agreement and put an end to the Israeli regime's relentless and blatant violations. He stressed that Hezbollah remains committed to the ceasefire agreement, but is ready to defend Lebanon if diplomacy fails. The Hezbollah leader accused Israel of pursuing expansionist goals, citing its unrelenting strikes and illegal presence in Lebanon. Now, he was speaking on the occasion of the International Quds Day. Sheikh Naim Qassem stressed that this is a day for confronting oppression everywhere and standing in solidarity with Palestine and all the oppressed people around the world. The Islamic movement in Nigeria has condemned the brutal attack on the Quds Day rally, resulting in the killing of at least six demonstrators and the arrests of hundreds. Our correspondent, Najim Abdullahi, has the details from Abuja, the Nigerian capital.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria has held a press conference following the Nigerian army's crackdown on protesters who were holding a rally in Abuja on the International Quds Day. Addressing a press conference, the Islamic movement said while the Quds Day rally was held peacefully in many countries of the world, it was marred by violence in Abuja, Nigeria's capital city. Members of the Islamic movement expressed their strong condemnation of the brutality of the Quds Day attack, saying there was no form of provocation from the demonstrators that warranted the high level of violence unleashed by Nigerian security forces, resulting in loss of lives and injuries.
Reliable information confirmed that the Guard Brigade and the police have arrested 380 protesters, including women and children. So far, we have six bodies that have been killed, and the number is changing, because we have some information that some have been killed and been taken away to some undisclosed hospitals.
The Islamic movement said this incident is the latest in a series of similar events where security forces have been abusing their power by targeting innocent and defenseless civilians who are exercising their legal rights. They accused the Nigerian authorities of double standards because while they give the impression of supporting Palestine abroad, they attacked and killed free Palestinian demonstrators at home.
We are demanding for, one, unconditional release of all that have been arrested in connection with the 2025 Abuja International Quds Day procession held on the 28th of March 2025. We are also demanding the prosecution of those responsible for the killings.
Meanwhile, the Nigerian police force has accused the demonstrators of killing one of its officers, a claim the Islamic movement has denied. The Islamic movement continues to reiterate that it is not a violent group and has never advocated any form of violence in its religious activities. It says that violence usually erupts when security forces arrive to disrupt its peaceful activities. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Now, since the new regime took power in Syria, the country has seen no political stability, only worsening economic and security crises. Now, Abu Mohammed al-Jolani had promised an inclusive transitional government by the 1st of March. Instead, he issued a constitutional declaration, leaving many Syrians disillusioned and fueling uncertainty about Syria's future.
The constitutional declaration was expected to lay the foundation for a democratic transition that represents all Syrians. Instead, it centralized power in the hands of Jolani, granting him absolute control over government appointments, including ministers, third of the parliament, and a committee that will appoint the rest, while restricting any oversight on his authority.
The declaration contradicts the aspirations of Syrians for democracy, political pluralism, and peaceful power transition. Instead of allowing the people to elect their leaders, it strips them of that right. Even the parliament can neither grant confidence to the government nor hold it accountable.
Critics argue that the declaration lacks true democratic foundations, concentrating authority in a single leader rather than ensuring fair representation for all components of Syrian society. The disappointment appeared in the small number of people celebrating the anniversary of the Syrian revolution, which did not exceed a few hundred.
Unfortunately, the constitutional declaration leans away from democracy, placing excessive power in the hands of the president and excluding genuine participation. Worse, it addresses transitional justice selectively, shifting all blame to one side instead of ensuring accountability for all parties.
Beyond legal concerns, recent events on the Syrian coast have raised serious fears about the country's future. Armed factions linked to the new regime have been accused of grave human rights violations, including mass killings, acts that some experts warn may amount to crimes of genocide.
What happened in the Syrian coastal region raises serious concerns about the future and the potential for further oppression. While I hope for a solution that satisfies all Syrians, the current situation leaves many in fear of what's to come.
As Syrians grapple with a deepening crisis, the constitutional declaration has only added to political discontent and growing fears about the country's future. With power concentrated at the top and violence escalating, hopes for democracy seem more distant than ever. Ali Mohammed, Damascus.
And with that report, we come to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Since Israel's invasion of Palestine and the occupation of the Jordan River cities, many religious scholars express concern over the development. The religious scholars of Cairo, Medina, Istanbul, Qom, and Najaf reacted differently to the occupation. Following these reactions, Arab nations and states described the occupation of Palestine as a national and ethnic issue, leading to the formation of a joint Arab front. In those years, socialist movements in Arab countries united under the Ba'ath Party. However, after successive defeats of the joint Arab front against Israel, the fervor gradually died down and the countries accepted the situation. Under these circumstances, the scholars of Najaf and Qom had a different reaction to the Zionist occupation. They frame the Palestinian issue as an Islamic one, considering Israel's existence and the continuation of its occupation as opposition to Islam. Among these scholars was Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri, the founder of the Qom Seminary School. Among them, we can mention Ruhollah Musavi Khomeini, one of Ayatollah Burujerdi's students, and Sayyid Musa Sadr, one of Allama Tabatabai's students. In the years following the Arabs' defeat by Israel, as many surrendered to Israel in one way or another. The Shia scholars of Najaf and Qom initiated a new movement based on Islamic values, rather than just national, ethnic, or Arab views. Meanwhile, Arab countries, mainly governed by pan-Arab and Ba'athist ideologies, were engulfed in internal strife, pushing the Palestinian issue to the sidelines. In Iran, the Pahlavi regime was closely aligned with Israel, to the extent that Iran was often considered another Israel. However, the people in Iran and Iraq, contrary to their governments, opposed Israel. Amid continued disputes between Mossadegh and the Shah over the closure of the Iranian embassy in Israel, Imam Khomeini began his struggle against the pro-Israel regime. In mid-1953, while many sought an end to the Shah's rule to eliminate foreign influence, for others it marked the beginning of a new movement. When Sayed Musa Saad graduated from Tehran University in 1953 with a degree in economics and law, he took a different path, leaving for Lebanon, a region under Israeli control. In the years following the defeat of the United Arab Army in 1948, nationalist socialist movements emerged in regional countries, evolving into powerful forces. New governments under the Ba'ath Party banner took power in Egypt, Iraq, Syria, and Jordan, all united by a common vision to restore Arab dignity. This national, or rather ethnic, pride fostered a collective spirit and determination to stand against Israel. During this period of rising ethnic pride, Sayed Musa Saad was actively working in Beirut, Lebanon, addressing the needs of the less privileged areas. Lebanon faced more social disunity compared to other Arab countries due to its religious, intellectual, and ethnic diversity, which prevented the regional fervor from taking root. Through his efforts in meeting various people and offering support, Sayed Musa Saad became a unifying figure in Lebanon. He engaged in debates within Lebanese intellectual movements, reaching out to Shia and Sunni religious groups, and supported oppressed communities. While Arab countries had been preparing to confront Israel for years, progress was not as anticipated. Imam Khomeini launched his campaign against the Pahlavi regime in Iran, having warned the Shah on numerous occasions through letters about the detrimental effects of American-Israeli policies. In June 1963, following his efforts to raise awareness through speeches, the Pahlavi regime decided to arrest Imam Khomeini and subsequently exiled him. The Shah believed that Imam Khomeini's movement was confined to Iran's borders and that exile would resolve the issue. However, Imam Khomeini's goal was broader, to awaken the people across the entire region under Shia religious authority. After the people in Arab countries and their military movements felt their national ethnic pride had been awakened, Israel launched a preemptive strike to prevent their forces from integrating. On January 5, 1967, Israel captured the Gaza Strip, the West Bank of the Jordan River, the Sinai Desert, and the Golan Heights in just 6 days. Israel's territory expanded more than threefold in this short period. The Arabs, who had been preparing to confront Israel, were taken by surprise and found themselves in a weak position. Israel continued its advance, reaching within 40 kilometers of Damascus, which would have been a devastating blow to the United Arab Front. In response, Arab nations stood against Israel with all their might to mitigate the defeat. Iraq, coordinating with Egypt, reinforced forces in northern Syria to halt Israel's progress. Israel, having achieved significant success, did not engage in a war of attrition and set conditions for a peace deal that the joint Arab front eventually agreed to under those terms. The defeat in the Six-Day War dealt a harder blow to the Arab nations. A few years passed since that war, and Arab countries decided to retaliate and restore their lost reputation. During those years, the Shah of Iran had been investing a substantial amount of money in Israel's reconstruction. In Israel's most critical situations, the Shah provided a glimmer of hope by supplying the regime with oil. By not supporting the Arab movement, he indirectly strengthened Israel in its fight against the Arab states. Saturday, October 6, 1973. Syria from the north, followed by Egypt from the south, launched surprise attacks on Israel. Initially, the operation favored Syria and Egypt, but gradually, with foreign aid, Israel countered the Egyptian and Syrian armies on two fronts. The Egyptian army was surrounded by the Sinai Desert, and for the first time, Israel entered Egypt's main territory by crossing the west bank of the Nile. In the north, Israel penetrated deep into Syrian territory, with Israeli artillery striking the suburbs of Damascus. After days of intense conflict, on October 25, 1973, the battle finally ended with a UN resolution backed by the United States and the Soviet Union. However, the truce resulted in agreements that brought shame and silence for all Arab countries. During those years, Sayed Musa Sadr had emerged as a prominent leader for the people of Lebanon, earning him the title of Imam Musa Sadr. Imam Musa Sadr began his influential activities soon after arriving in Lebanon. 2 years before the Yom Kippur War, another Iranian, Mostafa Chamran, joined him in Lebanon to help expand his efforts. Chamran, who had studied plasma physics and electromechanics in American universities, was an activist leading student movements in the U.S. against the Shah of Iran. His arrival in Lebanon and meeting with Imam Musa Sadr prompted increasing monitoring by Iran's intelligence and security organization, SABAK, due to his proximity to Israel, the Shah's ally. Dr. Chamran's collaboration with Imam Musa Sadr aimed to organize Lebanese youth, particularly the Shia minority, who were involved in Lebanon's complex and tribal political landscape. With Musa Sadr's presence, they not only maintained structural integrity, but also acted with unity. Under the watchful eyes of SABAK and Mossad, Sadr and Chamran gathered Lebanese Shia youths at Jebel Amel High School, where they provided technical and professional courses. These efforts fostered a strong relationship between the Lebanese youth, Dr. Chamran, and Imam Musa Sadr. The situation in Lebanon, with its predominantly Christian structure, kept the country somewhat distanced from the conflicts between Israel and the Arab nations. However, the presence of displaced Palestinians in Lebanese camps and the establishment of Palestinian resistance forces in Lebanon consistently generated tension in southern Lebanon. Imam Musa Sadr seized this opportunity to teach military principles to members of Amal. Israel posed a direct threat to the Lebanese people. While Lebanese Christian leaders had an unwritten agreement with Israel, the Lebanese Shias were rising from the ashes of Arab pride, not with Arab ideology, but with the concept of Islamic resistance against Israel. After the Camp David Accords and Egypt's withdrawal as one of Israel's most formidable enemies, the path was cleared for Israel to pursue its objectives. One of these goals was to dismantle Palestinian groups dreaming of confronting Israel and liberating Palestine. In the years following the Arab War, Palestinian resistance groups had formed, establishing their headquarters near the Israeli-occupied territories in southern Lebanon, perpetuating regional conflict and tension. A few years after the Yom Kippur War in 1978, and before the victory of the Iranian Revolution, the most serious clashes between Palestinian resistance groups and the Israeli army began. lacking substantial power. Palestinian forces were quickly forced out of southern Lebanon by Israel. However, Israel was not satisfied. The mere existence of Palestinian resistance groups meant the Palestinian dream remained alive. To crush that dream, these groups needed to be eliminated, alongside the Israelis searching for their adversaries in Lebanon. The Pahlavi regime was also hunting its opponents in the region. Iran's intelligence and security organization, SAVAK, had a strategic cooperation with Israel's Mossad since its establishment. Training SAVAK forces in Israel by Mossad and exchanging intelligence were key aspects of this cooperation. According to Mossad documents, SAVAK conducted activities abroad to ensure Israel's security and control opposition to the regime in regional countries. These activities included gathering intelligence and espionage in Egypt, Iraq, and Syria. One of the most sensitive countries for both SAVAK and the Mossad was Lebanon. Therefore, SAVAK sought to prevent Lebanon's unification with Egypt, Iraq, and Syria by influencing its ethnic and religious communities, including Christians and Shias, from the early years. SAVAK's mission was to ease Israel's concerns about Lebanon. The relative security of Lebanon had consequences for the Pahlavi regime. The relative peace in Lebanon and the country's non-interference in the Arab alliance against Israel made Lebanon a fertile ground for organizing and equipping Pahlavi opposition groups. Lebanon was a target for both SAVAK and Mossad in a deal where they supported each other. Mossad assisted SAVAK with training, equipment, and intelligence. However, these conditions gradually became more challenging for SAVAK, especially after an Iranian guest, well known by SAVAK forces, and the former head of SAVAK, Taimur Bakhtiar, went to Lebanon. After the coup on August 19, 1952, and the establishment of SAVAK, Taimur Bakhtiar was appointed as its first head. In the early years, organizing Iran's security situation, which still had significant opposition to the Shah and support for Mossadegh, or the Tudeh party, highlighted the importance of Bakhtiar's role in SAVAK. However, the longer Bakhtiar remained in his position, the more he became aware of the Pahlavi regime's corruption. In February 1961, when Bakhtiar was tasked by the Shah to deliver a message to John F. Kennedy, Kennedy's conversation with Bakhtiar about U.S. concerns over the corruption and inefficiency of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi's rule angered the Shah. Upset that Kennedy had shared these concerns with Bakhtiar, the Shah removed him from SAVAK within a month. Bakhtiar stayed in Iran for a few months, but his alignment with those opposing the Pahlavi regime was unacceptable to the Shah. Consequently, Bakhtiar was exiled a year later. Exile did not improve the situation. Bakhtiar openly expressed his opposition to the Shah and the ruling regime in West Germany, Italy, and Switzerland. SAVAK reports indicated that Bakhtiar was constantly under surveillance by SAVAK agents, who even accused him of an assassination attempt on the Shah. Additionally, Bakhtiar's frequent trips to Lebanon and his relationship with Imam Musa Sadr were major concerns for the Shah and SAVAK. During those years, SAVAK and the Shah made several attempts to influence the Amal movement by praising Chamran and Imam Musa Sadr, but these efforts failed. The Shah and SAVAK were aware of Imam Musa Sadr's influence in Lebanon, a concern shared by Israel, which had tasked Iran with controlling the Amal movement. However, the situation continued to deteriorate. On April 12, 1968, Taimur Bakhtiar visited Lebanon, as he had done on previous occasions. This time, however, he was arrested by Lebanese forces. The Shah, attempting to secure Bakhtiar's return, offered several million dollars in bribes to the Lebanese authorities and promised a special plane for his transfer under complete control. Despite these efforts, the Lebanese authorities refused to hand over Bakhtiar. Imam Musa Sadr intervened, asking the Lebanese authorities to release Bakhtiar, and his mediation led to Bakhtiar's eventual release. The Shah's attempt to arrest Bakhtiar and establish a successful relationship with Imam Musa Sadr and Chamran had failed. More importantly, SAVAK and Mossad were concerned about Imam Musa Sadr's growing influence among various Lebanese communities. With Sadr's power increasing, Israel had no choice but to kidnap Imam Musa Sadr. On August 31, 1978, Imam Musa Sadr traveled to Libya at the invitation of Muammar Gaddafi. After that trip, no one saw Imam Musa Sadr again. The Lebanese authorities pursued the matter, but Gaddafi claimed that Imam Musa Sadr had left Libya for Rome, a claim Italy immediately refuted. Despite frequent discussions, Lebanon was ultimately deprived of Imam Musa Sadr. A few months later, the Iranian Revolution would overthrow the monarchical regime allied with Israel. In Imam Musa Sadr's absence, the youth of Amal had only one hope, Dr. Chamran. However, with the victory of the Iranian Revolution, Chamran returned to Iran to serve his homeland, for which he had tirelessly worked to liberate. Upon Chamran's arrival in Iran, Amal's youths followed, utilizing their experiences from Lebanon to establish the headquarters of irregular warfare. The bond between Iran and Lebanon was stronger than Israel could have imagined. The roots cultivated over years under the shadow of Mossad and Savak had emerged. Consequently, Israel concluded that its survival depended on an attack on Lebanon to achieve its objectives there. January 6, 1982. As Iran and Iraq were deeply engaged in a war, Israel entered Lebanon under the pretext of combating Palestinian resistance movements. Israel occupied the Shia areas in southern Lebanon, resulting in the displacement of hundreds of thousands of people. The Maronite Christian forces, known as the Phalanx, aligned with Israel, making Lebanon unsafe for Shias and Palestinian resistance forces in the northern regions. The Amal movement forces emerged as the sole protectors of the Lebanese in this dire situation. Urban warfare had been raging in Lebanon for several months. Meanwhile, Iran was focused on fighting and recapturing its cities. These efforts culminated on May 24, 1982, with the liberation of Khorramshahr, Iran's most significant fallen city, which had become a symbol of resistance. After reclaiming Khorramshahr, Iranian forces began to concentrate their efforts beyond their borders, with Lebanon becoming a new focal point for them. June 13, 1982, Iran, in coordination with the Supreme Council of Defense, sent forces from the Muhammad Rasulullah Brigade under the command of Ahmad Mutawassilian to Lebanon. The brigade's mission was to assist Lebanese forces and fight against Israel. Initially, the Iranian forces were deployed to Damascus and then transferred to Lebanon via land routes. A few days after their arrival, Imam Khomeini became aware of their presence and, prioritizing the Iranian fronts, ordered their return to Iran. Consequently, the Muhammad Rasulullah Brigade returned to Iran and was stationed on Iran's fronts. However, Ahmad Mutawassilian and several other commanders remained in Lebanon to complete their mission. Mutawassilian, one of the most experienced Iranian commanders, had extensive combat experience from the war in Iran's Kurdistan against the so-called Democratic Party, making him adept at leading urban warfare and organizing forces. These capabilities had gone unnoticed by Israel. The presence of such a commander in Lebanon was concerning for Israel. With no news of Imam Musa Sadr and Dr. Chamran, Ahmad Mutawassilian established a new line of resistance in Lebanon. July 4, 1982. A meeting was held at the Iranian embassy in Beirut to evaluate the activities and achievements of Ahmad Mutawassilian and the Muhammad Rasulullah Brigade in Lebanon. It was decided that all remaining groups of Iranian troops in Lebanon would travel to Damascus on July 6th and return to Iran. Sayed Mohsen Mousavi, the chargé d'affaires of the Iranian embassy, suggested that before returning, they could visit Baalbek and the suburbs of Beirut to inspect the region and prepare a report. On the morning of July 5, 1982, Ahmad Mutavassilian, Iranian diplomat Mousavi, and two Iranian journalists, Taghir Astigar Mughaddam and Kazem Akhavan, were heading to the outskirts of Beirut. On their way to a checkpoint, they encountered Falange forces, who were waiting for them. This was the last known information about the passengers of the Iranian diplomatic car in Lebanon. After that, no one heard from them again, similar to what had happened with Imam Musa Sadr. The movement formed by the presence of Iranian forces in Lebanon would soon reshape relations between Lebanon and the region. A new force would be established in Lebanon, which would not only become a significant chapter for Lebanese movements like Amal, but also open a new chapter in the confrontation with Israel.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
A bowli fell down and passed the night in wailing and lamenting. Someone threw a stone down onto his head and said, Didst thou ever go to anyone's assistance that thou shouldn't today cry out for help? Didst thou ever sow the seeds of virtue? Who would place a savior upon thy bounds when the hearts of all cry out by reason of thy tyrannies? Across our path thou didst dig a pit, into which, perforce, hast thou now fallen. If thou do evil, expect not goodness. Never does the withered grapevine bring forth fruit. O thou who sowest the seed in autumn, I think not that thou wilt reap the corn at harvest time. If thou nourish the thorn tree of the desert, think not that thou wilt ever eat its fruit. Green dates come not from the poisonous trees when thou sowest the seed. Hope only for the fruit of that very seed. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to all of you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of For a Better Life. Well, today this is Nahid having the honor of hosting you on another episode. As we just started today's program, We heard some short parts of Sani Shirazi's Bustan, the famous Iranian poet and prose writer, and we are going to consider the fruits of the seeds that we plant, the every single act that we are making in our lives, and how the effects and the fruits are going to be seen, both in this life and hereafter. Well, when looking at the history of the Holy Prophet and the way he and his great family used to live and behave, we see how much they were oppressed and bullied by others who were jealous of their position and status. People used to insult and disrespect them, but at the same time, he didn't fail to realize that God places himself in this position. So regarding all the bullies and all the misbehaviors he could observe, he's still there, being the prophet, the one who was the sample of honesty, the sample of kindness, and the glorious example of the religion he was advertising, the religion he was introducing to the people. They wanted to put out the light of God with their mouth, but God will certainly make his light shine forever, even though the disbelievers may dislike this. So, the negative attribute of bullying is very important in the societies also today. Like, there are very alarming statistics about bullying, which says that every 3 students have been reported that they had experienced being bullied throughout the school years. In the Holy Book of Quran, we have the clear verse mentioning it this way. Believers, let not a group of you mock another. Perhaps they are better than you. Let not women mock each other. Perhaps one is better than the other. Let not one of you find faults in another, nor let any one of you defame another. Bullying is a form of oppression too, which is a weakness, because the one oppressing is either doing so out of the need of something or out of ignorance. Oppressors think that they are strong and overpowering others, but they are doing so out of a deficiency in their own selves. We also find some people try to lay the blame on God for the oppression happening in this world. That has led many down a dark path towards atheism. However, God is incapable of doing injustice because it is contradictory to his essence. Let us take a closer look at what injustice happens so that we have a better understanding to clear this doubt. Injustice happens for one of the reasons that we are going to mention them after a very short break.
ارتباطتون رو با خدا قوی کنید. در مسائل دینی به نقاط عقلانی و ظریف.
Improve your connection with God. Pay attention to logical and detailed points in religious issues and learn them from great masters. There are sentiments in religion, but they rely on deep ideality and deep thought. This thought must be learned.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Welcome to For a Better Life, where today we are talking about the effects of the seeds that we plant. If we plant the seeds of bullying others, the fruit is going to be something dark and poisonous, and the first person to get affected by that poisonous fruit is no one but us. Well, regarding the doubt that some people put in the injustice of Astaghfirullah, let's say, with the injustice of the creator and the maker of the whole world, the first reason is that we have found that this reason is rooted on the thing that they feel they are empty themselves and they just want to put the blame on something outside their own circle. So we commit injustice while being ignorant of the harmful effects of that sin, while God is incapable of ignorance. So he is not the one who might not know the effect on other people. And someone forces us to commit injustice, while it is impossible for anyone to force God to do anything like that. The other thing which is really clear is that we commit injustice to someone out of need for something that they have. While God is free from need, we call him Al-Ghani, and he is the creator of all things. Next reason, which is talking for itself, we commit injustice for the pleasure of that deed. While God is not in need of seeking pleasure and does not have emotional states that change, like we humans do. So now we can see that all of the reasons that we just mentioned are signs of deficiencies, and it is impossible for God to have deficiencies or be unjust to his servants. Injustice is from man himself misusing the favors that God has bestowed upon him. God does not do the least bit of injustice to anyone, but people rank themselves. Now, how did the noble family of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi wa sallam deal with bullying so that we can use their behavior as the sample, as the role model for ourselves, because we are also living and we might be exposed to these situations? Upon declaring his prophethood, Prophet Muhammad was treated very badly by the rest of the Arabs, and even some of his own relatives turned against him. Despite all the odds against him, he overcame all obstacles through patience and having a strong connection to God. Help yourselves in your affairs with patience and praise. It is a difficult task indeed, but not for the humble ones who are certain of their meeting with their Lord and their return to him. And in the other verse, we have this clearly mentioned that believers, help yourselves in your affairs through patience and prayer. God is with those who have patience. The other verse glorifies the sample more clearly. After every difficulty, there is relief. So knowing those concepts, knowing these steps to take regarding the way to behave when we are bullied, that I hope we see it less and less in the society and community of Muslims, we can consider the process and the way as put into the way of believing in God. The solution is this simple. Just know that there is God and that God is seeing you in all situations. Well, with the reminder in mind that bullying is nothing that can be the seeds a Muslim can plant, since no Muslim wants the fruit of the poisonous tree of bullying and making fun of others, we are recommended to keep brotherhood and keep the same vibe as the time of our great prophet. We are not like him, of course, but at least we can try to take him as the role model and go through the great straight path that he had to the proximity of the one who is the most beloved one of all. Well, with these little reminders that can change big changes, let's end today's episode of For a Better Life. I wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there. Be there.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Yemeni armed forces say that they have targeted U.S. aircraft carrier USS Harry S. Truman in the Red Sea with missiles and drones in support of Palestine. Sirens blare in Tel Aviv and several other cities across the Israeli-occupied lands as Yemen fires hypersonic missiles at Ben-Gurion Airport. Also in the headlines, more Palestinians fall victim to Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, while the regime's military starts a new phase of ground operations in Rafah. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The Yemeni military says it's carried out fresh anti-U.S. operations as the Arab country continues to support Palestine amid the ongoing Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. تواصل قواتنا المسلحة